This is Virginia Voice Program Director Teresa Ray, welcoming you to Voices from the Mighty Pen. Virginia Voice is proud to bring you this program in partnership with the Virginia War Memorial Foundation's Mighty Pen Project. The Mighty Pen Project is a free writing course for veterans, helping create, preserve, share, and honor their stories for us all. In this series, you'll hear stories written by Richmond area veterans through the Mighty Pen Project, then read by the authors in our Virginia Voice studios. This program recounts the experiences of veterans who served in active duty and may describe scenes of combat. Listener discretion is advised, particularly for those who live with PTSD. These stories may contain graphic language, graphic accounts of violence, and other potentially triggering content. Now, Virginia War Memorial Foundation and Virginia Voice present Voices from the Mighty Pen.
Weight and balance. You used to wake up to sounds of mortars exploding 10 kilometers from your dust-filled tent, or the rev of rotors starting to turn, and the slow grumble of the chopper engine. You've awakened to the melody of reveille, the soothing rhythm of soldiers calling cadence, and to the crackling of snow as ice shifts in your two-man igloo. Now on most days you wake up only to hear the soft sound of your alarm, on others to the imagined echoes of those memories. And sometimes waking is something you willingly do, so you can accomplish a new mission, a mission struggling to find purpose, cause, craving the balance on which you used to rely. You used to wake up knowing a century of men and women depended on your actions, decisions, knowledge, humanity, and trust in them. Today, you can barely find a dozen. So sometimes waking is something you reluctantly do, for in the depths of REM, you are there with them, and it is real, for a moment. With Michael in your office, shaking his hand, commending him for volunteering, for stepping up to join his fellow brothers and sisters, for going, even with a pregnant wife, for being a model for others, especially to his daughter, whom he would only hold once, but who may forever feel her father's presence. It is when you wake that you feel his presence in his absence. It is in the house of your subconscious that you sit with Sarah, talk about leadership, flying, empathy, and risk, where you take her on a test flight to see the beauty of Denali over 150 miles away, but who begs you to touch it. It's so close. That majestic mountain is what dreaming feels like, being 150 miles away. No, 1,500 miles away. If only. Being an immeasurable distance away, but begging to reach out your hand and touch, if even for a moment. It is when you wake that you feel her presence and her absence. And so you make it your new mission to find a way to communicate, to serve your penance for surviving, to make work, a community, progress, to make peace. It is when you wake that you carry the weight and search for the balance.
All right, read number two, The Ride.
The Ride, yes, sir. The Ride. It was clear blue in 22. You couldn't describe it any other way. A decade of flying forced you to become a novice meteorologist, to pay attention to moon cycles, sunrise and sunset, to EENT and cloud ceilings, that a small difference between temperature and dew point caused fog, that winds at altitude affect your burn rate. Even now, 4 years later, and probably 40 after that, you'll note the position of the moon and know that it will be 15 degrees lower in an hour. And the underside faces of leaves. Drive past a flag or even, ironically, a windsock and determine which direction you would have landed. But you're on four wheels now, not three. The only thing over top you is a worn-out canvas, a bikini top that covers only the front seats. And this top flaps in the wind, passive, affected by the wind, not active, not affecting the wind, not working in unison with three others to produce lift. These wheels, they stay on the ground. Leaves and twigs, remnants of rainwater and splashes of mud are your passengers in the back. Even the maple's occasional propeller seed comes along for the ride, and you chuckle at the irony. You can fit only two people in the back of that beauty of your 95 red Jeep Wrangler, not the 11 that you could in that mammoth, the back of that beauty of that 88 OD green UH60 Alpha. Now you can pick up two friends and go where your heart's desire, spend all day along the river or in a museum. Then you idly chat over drinks at a restaurant patio and drop them back off at home again. Like those before that you flew along the river or over top a museum that you, not so idly, chatted with over the intercom and dropped back off at home. Yet too, unlike those before, those who you dropped off with their rucks fully loaded, with their radios and medical kits, rations and munitions, that you dropped off with their maps and their Bibles. Unlike those before, those who you dropped off, never to pick up again. It's been hard for you, hard to find two people, even two, to fill the void where those 11 sat before. Maybe because you weren't even trying. Maybe it because it was easier. Easier to close the door, zip up the sides, chock the wheels, and let the battery die over the winter. But when the seasons changed, when the earth tilted to enjoy the company of the sun, you knew it was time to fly again. So you brushed off that bikini top and unzipped the sides. You welcomed the company of the leaves and the twigs and those little propeller seeds, and you went for a ride. The breeze brushed up against your face, and you put your hand out, cupping it up and down, forming that airfoil that would fly. The same airfoil you formed in the back seat at the age of 5 without a care. Not a single one. Now you formed it as a way to let those cares spread their wings. To fly a little farther. Up ahead you see another Jeep, and as you pass he gives you a wave. And you wave back and smile. And sink in the warmth and comfort and let it wrap around you. And know that you are part of a community. A community different from the one before, but one that will wave and welcome you as long as you pull out of the driveway and go for a ride.
Alicia, let's talk.
Yes.
What did the Mighty Pen Project do to help you put all these words on paper?
Well, I mean, as you can probably tell from my readings, a lot of the things that I loved about the military was the community and just being part of the team. And that's for me what the Mighty Pen Project did. It was a group of people from very different experiences, different generations of military experience, all sitting around just so open and so willing to listen, whether it's through conversation or through paper. And for me, I've always found I'm just more open if I can put it down on paper first.
How do they teach you to do that?
Oh, the instructors there are amazing, and there are quite a few. I took it with David Robbins, and he just has a way of really pushing you to not pushing you to put down what sometimes you don't want to say aloud, and that there is a release in that. And one of the things that I found so powerful, you'll notice both of these are in third person. So in giving the story to someone else, you don't have to carry that by yourself. So some people will create a character that has these adventures or has these experiences. And by putting those experiences on someone else, they can carry that, which is really powerful.
That's an interesting way of putting it, because many of the readers have told very horrible war stories, mm-hmm. things that have happened to them or their buddies,
right.
And they bring that home with them and putting it on paper. Yours are rather uplifting in a way.
Yeah. My experience in the military is vastly positive. I lost several friends in that. Was extremely difficult, But really, for me, it's the community aspect, and sort of, I almost look at it perhaps in a nostalgic way a little bit. So they can sort of be uplifting. In the military, I fit in the Army like a square peg in a square hole. I had a mission. I had a task. I got up in the morning, and I had some sense of purpose. And it's really in the civilian sector that I'm searching for those things that came a little bit more naturally in the military.
You flew helicopters. Many people have flown airplanes, but helicopter is a different animal. Helicopter works differently. It flies differently. It feels different when you're even a passenger. Mm-hmm. How did you get into that?
Well, I remember I would go to the hospital that my mom worked at, and I would see the medevac helicopters landing on the rooftops. And I was, you know, 6, 7 years old, and I remember from a young age wanting to fly. So when I got into high school, I called around to the medevac pilots in the area. I said, "How did you become a pilot?" And 9 out of 10 of them said, "The military." So I said, "All right, I'm going to join the Army then. I want to be a helicopter pilot."
Was flying helicopters as you thought it would be?
Every time. It really never got old for me. That feeling when the wheels get light right before takeoff and then you lift off the ground, there's just something indescribable about that moment. And it was something that gave me butterflies each and every time. You get to see the world from a different perspective. And I think that changed the way that I see a lot of things, not just literally, but in every way, it's a different perspective when you get the overview shot.
You left piloting behind today. You're an artist.
I am. I am a furniture maker and do public and private commissions, as well as making work about my military experience. So it really runs the gamut.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. The only thing, my name is pronounced Alicia.
Alicia, okay.
Yep. So that was the only thing.
Okay.
Like Alicia and the Militia.
One time our helicopter pilot flew under the Lee Bridge.
Oh, wow.
What are you trying to prove?
Sometimes the worst thing a pilot can say is "watch this." You never want to hear a pilot say that.
Would you like to experience auto rotation? No!
Yeah, as a maintenance test pilot, I got to do that. You know, you put the engines back to idle so that you can test the auto-rotational capability mm-hmm. of the aircraft. And, man, a Black Hawk sinks like a rock. It goes straight down. You're looking at out the foot bubble of where your pedals are. That's where that's where your trajectory is going.
I didn't realize it was that fast.
Yeah, there's not very much
distance. It's a hard landing, but you walk away from it.
You do. That's the goal.
Walk away from is a good landing.
That's the goal.
Thank you, Alicia.
Thank you.
"For You I Will" by Bobby Blakely.
My heart is almost in my hand, pounding, trying to break free from my chest. Every breath is faint and shallow. I'm gasping for more. I'm dying. If I could just stop everything from spinning, if I can just catch my breath. These were becoming suicide missions. I had to stop. To survive in this moment, I needed everything to stop. I slow my pace to a halt. Just as I'm beginning to save my own life, a voice yells, "What in the hell do you think you're doing, Blakely?" I need his voice to stop as well. "Do you think you're too cute to run in my Navy?" I don't answer. Are you too good to run in my Navy? I barely glance in my assailant's direction. Get your ass back running now. I can't. I grab my chest. The drill instructor puts his hand to his chin. He's thinking of another way he can take me out. Ladies, Blakely feels she's too good to run in my Navy. So for every lap she doesn't finish, you all will run 2 laps for. He has successfully put another hit out on my life. I hear the groans and verbal assaults hurl as the other girls run past me. One bumps into me. Move your ass, Blakely. I still don't care. My self-preservation is in my hands alone. I need to lie down, regain my breath, calm my heart rate. A patch of shaded grass calls me to lie down while the other girls run their laps. A girl named Jones locks arms with mine. Run with me, Blakely. Just keep my pace. I didn't like Jones, and I didn't appreciate her using me to show the drill instructor she would be a perfect leader for the Navy. I free myself. Nah, I'm good. Jones hissed. If you don't finish your laps, they're going to kill you when we get back. Now run with me and finish your laps. Her pace was a fast walk, but still a pace I could barely maintain. Somehow, I managed to finish. Back at the ship, all hell broke loose. I was pissed I had risked my life running in the heat, and several girls were upset that they might have had to finish my laps. One girl shouted, "You're so fucking lucky I didn't have to run those laps for you." That was it. I ran up on her. "So what if you fucking had? I do push-ups for y'all sorry asses all the damn time." The truth of the matter was, while I wasn't a runner, I did push-ups and sit-ups like a champ. Half these girls could barely do 5, and I could do 100 perfect push-ups. Baza, a Filipina, walks between us. "Let's go, Blakely." Baza drags me away. I look over my shoulder and I mouth, "You fucking dumbass." "You know, Blakely, you're going to have to figure out your running situation. You won't pass battle stations unless you can run." Baza was right. Battle stations was the gatekeeper between boot camp and joining the Navy. All we knew about it is that it was a 24-hour event and you ran the whole time. I should have heeded Baza's warning. The first time I participated in battle stations, I was pulled out because I couldn't breathe during one of the running sessions. The next time, I was determined to make it through, including the seabag drill. A team running half a mile with a seabag full of weapons. You were supposed to run laps and then pass it, with the weapons inside. The bag could weigh easily over 80 pounds. I had run for laps, and it was time for me to pass my seabag. A skinny guy ran beside me. "Grab the seabag." He shook his head. "Huh? Take the damn seabag." He proceeded to outrun me so he didn't have to take the sea bag. I went from running a lap to chasing this guy down just so he could take the sea bag. Another guy whipped the bag off my back, and I finished my last laps, but something was seriously wrong. As we're running to our next station, the drill instructor runs up. "Are you limping?" "No, there's a rock in my boot. I'll get it out the next station." I finished the next drill, a shooting simulation, and began to run in formation. The drill instructor comes up. "Fall out, Blakely." "What's wrong? What did I do?" My eyes are glossy, and watershed of tears is about to hit my eyes. My voice quivers. "What did I do wrong?" He scribbles a note and hands it to me. "Head to medical first thing in the morning." What I have been ignoring all night suddenly hits me. My body feels as if it's on fire. Back at my ship, I hand the note to the drill instructor on duty. My eyes and buddy shut down. The next morning, I limp over to medical and I explain the last night I was called out of battle stations. They take x-rays and other tests. A doctor comes out. "How are you feeling, young lady?" "Fine." "You're going to be here with us for another 6 to 8 weeks. You have fractures throughout your knees and shins. The good news is your hips are fine. You need to be fitted for crutches. You'll start physical therapy next week." He hands me a stack of papers to give to my drill instructor. The next morning at chow, I'm told to go directly to the ship, accompanied by 2 girls. "Pack it up, Blakely, you're being moved." I purposefully took my sweet time, irritating these broads one last time. At my new ship, one of the girls hands over the paperwork to the drill instructor. This ship was quieter. No bunks, like the hospitals and movies where all the soldiers are bandaged. "Does she need anything else?" one of the girls who walked me over asked. A soft, direct voice says, No, she good. You can leave. We got her. The reality of me now being in a medical holding unit hits. My eyes gloss over as if Niagara Falls is behind them. A tall, pale Latina girl with dark hair and eyes says, "My name is Herbert." I point to my name on the left of my chest, not saying a word, and collapse on the bed. Niagara Falls finally releases from my eyes. And Herbert says, "It's okay, Blakely. Don't be sad. We'll look out for you." She gives me a sincere hug, but quickly, as we're not allowed to touch. She hands me a pink tissue that smells of roses, clearly contraband. "Where did you get this?" I buy them on my commissary runs. The simple thought alone made me bust out laughing so hard I surely looked crazy. A short, pretty black girl with the name Miles on her shirt comes up. "Hi," she says with a deep Alabama accent. "We'll put your stuff away." "No, it's okay. Thanks for the offer. I have a small form of OCD. I should do it myself." "No, let us do it. You can order us around from the bed or cry, laugh, whatever you want." I become super fond of both of them immediately. Over the next few weeks, Herbert and I become best friends. Her first name was Sarah, and she knew mine. No one else besides the drill instructors ever knew my first name. We walked to physical therapy sessions and bought contraband. Every Sunday, I dragged her to services so we could watch my fiancé, who didn't know he was my fiancé. We talked about the boys and friends we left to join the Navy, and the cute civilian clothes we'd buy once we left boot camp. We discussed our fears. Mostly, we laughed. For the first time since coming to boot camp, I felt like the 17-year-old girl I actually was. Love and laughter are good for the soul. They must be good for your body, too. At 6 weeks, I got my seal of good health, eligible to run battle stations for the third time. Rumor had it that if you failed battle stations 3 times, that was the end of your Navy career. No one knew for sure. Miles and I had both run it twice. Herbert's body broke down on her before she even got a chance. One night, all three of us sat eating forbidden candy and talking. "Blakely, do you think you'll make it?" My mood felt dark and I didn't answer. "You have to make it. You at least have to try." "Why?" "Because Miles and I can't run, but if we could, we would try, and try hard." "You also have to run for us because we're still broken and can't." I let Herbert's words sink in. "Then yes, if I have to run for the two of you, I'm going to try my hardest." I received word that I would be running battle stations with another ship. As I had done before, I met up with the hosting ship to begin the drills. I was feeling as if everything was a breeze. I was confident I would ease through this. But at the last of the drills, the fire station, something happened. Suddenly, I was tired and exhausted. "Line up," says the drill instructor. We run. I can feel it start. My heart crumbling through my chest. Everything spinning. I lag behind the rest of the formation. The drill instructor runs beside me. "Don't you stop, Blakely." I need to stop. I want to stop. I'm dying. I can feel myself dying. I can see and hear Herbert and Miles. "Blakely, we can't run. You have to run for us." I don't stop. I have to keep going for them. I'm so far behind, but I don't stop. Finally, I make it inside the dome with everyone else. I peel myself out of my battle gear. A girl whispers, "Did you even pass? You were so far behind." We line up for the swearing-in ceremony. It seems like an awful long time goes until my name is called. "Blakely, Blakely, where's Blakely?" Had I failed? Were they taking so long because they decided to pull me out of the ceremony? My legs get weak as I raise an embarrassed hand. "Here." The drill instructor speaks. "Once you finish swearing in, I want you to let me know how it feels to be a part of my Navy." Tears run down my face. The truth is, I was never actually sworn in because I was too busy crying. After the ceremony, we were granted a feast. Burgers, fries, cookies, and cake. All the food you were never allowed to eat in boot camp. But everything I put in my mouth tasted like dirt. I walked back to my medical holding ship. It was empty. Just the drill instructor and me. Not looking up, she asked, "Did you pass?" I nod. She gives me a smile. Good, Blakely. You deserve to be here. Go wash up. Do you mind if I get some rest after I shower? We were not allowed to sleep in the middle of the day unless we had a medical slip, but no one was there and I was so exhausted. Sure. I was getting the best sleep since coming to boot camp. Then whispers woke me. Herbert, Miles, and two other girls sat around my bed. You guys look so pretty. They were in civilian clothes and had done their hair, giving me a glimpse of who they truly were. Blakely, did you pass? Did you pass battle stations? I see the anxiousness in their eyes. I don't answer right away. Then I pop up and yell, I passed! They scream and smother me in hugs. The drill instructor looks more like a proud parent than a correction officer. I relish every hug, kiss, and tear. Before Herbert and Miles leave, I say, I ran for you guys. I didn't do it for me. I couldn't have done it for me. I ran for the two of you. 2 days later, without warning, I was moved to another ship to await orders for my Navy A school. I wasn't able to get any information that would give me hope of contacting Herbert or Miles before I left. This would continue to replay itself in my military career. I'd meet the best people only to never see them again. I encounter people who would rather knock me over than encourage me to keep going. And I was never able to do the hardest things just for myself. To this day, I'm grateful God allowed me to meet Herbert and Miles, because their inspiration and kindness will be with me all my life. Through them, I learned that the most difficult challenges would never be just about me. I would have to get through them for others.
You've been listening to Voices from the Mighty Pen, produced by Virginia Voice in partnership with the Virginia War Memorial Foundation's Mighty Pen Project. For more information on the Mighty Pen Project, visit vawarmemorial.org/learn. This is Teresa Ray for Virginia Voice.